Today is Friday, July 30th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. restores defense pact with Philippines amid South China Sea tensions.
A strong, resilient U.S.-Philippine alliance will remain vital to the security, stability, and prosperity of the Indo-Pacific.
First, thousands of Afghan refugees flee to Turkey amid intense clashes.
Officials and observers believe the numbers of Afghan refugees entering Turkey are estimated between 500 and 2,000 daily.
Also, COVID-19 deaths in Africa jumps to 17% in the past month. Our top story today is in the Philippines. President Rodrigo Duterte on Friday restored a crucial pact governing the presence of U.S. troops in the Philippines. The two countries' defense ministers said, reversing a decision that had caused increased concern in Washington and Manila. The Visiting Forces Agreement, or VFA, set rules for the rotation of thousands of U.S. troops in and out of the Philippines for training exercises. It has assumed additional importance as the United States and its allies contend with an increasingly assertive China. The Philippines is a U.S. treaty ally, and several military agreements are dependent on the VFA. Duterte vowed to terminate the pact after the United States denied a visa to a Philippine senator who is an ally of the president, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin.
Our countries face a range of challenges, from the climate crisis to the pandemic. And as we do, a strong, resilient U.S.-Philippine alliance will remain vital to the security, stability, and prosperity of the Indo-Pacific. At the top of my agenda was finding ways to enhance and reinvigorate our alliance and our mutual defense treaty. These include maritime cooperation, support to further modernize the armed forces of the Philippines, and investments that will help the Philippines navigate the region's complex security environment. You know, one of the reasons that I'm here today is to reaffirm that the U.S. security commitment to the Philippines is ironclad. And that commitment, as Secretary Blinken stated a while back, extends to the South China Sea.
That's U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. More than 200 people have arrived in the United States on the first evacuation flight for Afghans who worked alongside Americans in Afghanistan. The airliner carrying them landed early Friday at an airport just outside Washington, D.C. It carried Afghan interpreters and their family members, including children and babies in arms. The flights are dubbed Operation Allies Refuge and are intended to bring to the U.S. Afghans who are farthest along in their visa process. The interpreters, translators, and others fear reprisals from Afghanistan Taliban as the last U.S. troops leave. President Joe Biden says he's proud to tell the newly arrived Afghans, quote, welcome home, unquote. Despite a series of cautiously optimistic assessments by high-ranking U.S. military officials and Afghan leaders, a new report from the U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGR, describes the situation in Afghanistan as, quote, bleak, unquote. It warns the government of Ashraf Ghani could fall after U.S. and NATO troops complete their withdrawal in the coming weeks. On Thursday, John Sutko, the Special Inspector General, said there is still a chance for the Afghan government to turn things around. Michael Klugman, Deputy Director and Senior Associate of South Asia at the Wilson Center in Washington, discussed the challenges facing the Afghan government with International Edition's Steve Miller.
But I think that this notion of misplaced expectations, trying to exaggerate measures of death, trying to create a notion that success is possible in places where it's not, I think it's a very basic conclusion. But just the fact that for so many years, and up to now, just the sense that there could be ways to look for silver linings where they don't exist, you know, try to find glass half full views where they don't exist. I think that very simple point of the U.S. just not thinking about the war in the way that it should be thought about and just being over overly optimistic when that wasn't really realistic, so to speak. So for me, that's what sticks out beyond all the numbers and all the stats and all of that, that very basic point.
John Sopko, the U.S. Special Inspector General, said that there was still a chance for the Afghan government to turn things around. In your opinion, taking a look at what's been happening over the last month on the ground in Afghanistan, what do you see as what needs to happen for the government of Ashraf Ghani to turn things around after the U.S. and NATO forces leave and really not only sustain themselves in office, but also kind of jumpstart those peace talks that have been really stalled for quite a number of months?
Well, I think that there's one way that the government in Afghanistan can turn things around by trying to make better and more immediate efforts to improve coordination between the government and military leaders. One of the many reasons why the military has been struggling against the Taliban is that there just has not been good communication, coordination between the two. The military is not getting the materials, the supplies, as well as the guidance and leadership that it expects to get. And obviously, if that can change, if you can strengthen that coordination, boost morale within the Afghan security forces, make more military leaders more confident about what they need to do, that could improve battlefield performance. And that has potential to try to finally take some of the momentum out of these Taliban advances. And obviously, if you're able to put the Taliban on the defensive a bit and try to reduce these offensives a bit, that would then, I think, make the Afghan government more confident about going back into negotiations with the Taliban, because they would be able to be in a position to at least reduce a bit of the bargaining power that the Taliban currently has.
You know, on Wednesday, Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan said that because the United States was leaving unconditionally, it kind of gave up any kind of bargaining power with the Taliban. Regionally speaking, you know, what do you see as some of the major concerns of the parties that are there, given that the U.S. withdrawal will be completed in fairly short order?
Well, I think that one of the most immediate concerns for many of the countries bordering Afghanistan are refugee flows. We've already seen, as the violence has intensified and the offensives have continued to pace from the Taliban, so many people, thousands of people being displaced across Afghanistan. And that's only going to get worse. And you know, unfortunately, the countries that traditionally have taken in the most Afghan refugees, Pakistan and Iran, have been increasingly hesitant in recent months and really in recent years to try to bring in refugees. And in fact, Pakistan and Iran have also sought to repatriate a number of Afghan refugees that are already in these countries. So I think that is going to be the immediate fear, as well as the broader concerns about cross-border violence and militancy and all that. But I think that this refugee crisis is really going to be the first major policy challenge for neighboring states of Afghanistan after the withdrawal is complete.
That's Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center in Washington, speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. With the Taliban continuing to make advances in Afghanistan, growing numbers of Afghan refugees are starting to arrive in Turkey. With Turkey already hosting millions of refugees, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul that the government's refugee policy is facing growing scrutiny.
A video purportedly showing Afghan refugees found in a luggage compartment of a bus in Turkey is one of many postings flooding Turkish social media, showing Afghan refugees being smuggled in buses and trucks from neighboring Iran. Officials and observers believe the numbers of Afghan refugees entering Turkey are estimated between 500 and 2,000 daily, a relatively low number compared to the mass migrant movements that Turkey has seen in the past. But Hussein Barca of the Foreign Policy Institute in Ankara says Turkey's government has growing concerns that the numbers could surge if the Taliban seize power in Afghanistan.
The Iranians made their corridors to Turkey. All the Afghan people who run away come to Turkey, and Iran does not accept them and let them to go to Turkey. So it is another crisis. The refugee issue will be a very important domestic issue in the coming days.
Ankara is now extending a border wall to secure the whole of its nearly 300-kilometer frontier with Iran. Turkey already hosts around 3.5 million Syrian refugees and at least 100,000 Afghans who fled previous conflicts. Turkey's been acting as a gatekeeper for the European Union in exchange for billions of dollars in aid. The deal also gives Turkey substantial diplomatic leverage in its negotiations with the EU. But Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, leader of the main CHP party, is warning the government against making any new deal with the EU to host more refugees.
Ülkemizi parasıyla açık mülteci hapishanesine döndürdü.
Kılıçdaroğlu said the West has seen that it can turn Turkey into what he describes as an open prison for refugees. He says the influx of refugees is a real survival problem for Turkey. He says the issue has two victims, the Turkish people and those he refers to as our refugee brothers. Austria's Chancellor Sebastian Kurz added fuel to the controversy, declaring this month that Turkey and other countries in the region are definitely a better place than Austria, Germany or Sweden for Afghans who are forced to flee. Ankara has so far not announced its stance towards hosting any surge in Afghan refugees, but ministers in recent days have been extolling the virtues of hosting refugees, claiming they play a vital role in the Turkish economy. Some disagree. Atilla Yeşilada, an analyst for Global Source Partners, says the opposition leader Kılıçdaroğlu's efforts to block any new refugee deal will resonate in a country where many see the large influx of Afghan people as potentially destabilizing.
All the previous polls showed that regardless of party, Turks want them to go back. So that really strikes a tone with citizens and, more importantly, with the labor that's been replaced by Afghan and Syrian refugees.
A struggling economy hit hard by the COVID pandemic and soaring inflation are already raising tensions in Turkey. Analysts say there are mounting concerns a large-scale arrival of Afghan refugees could add to those tensions. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
There is growing international criticism of Israel following allegations that software from the private security company NSO was used to spy on journalists, dissidents, and even political leaders around the world. A group of American lawmakers is urging the U.S. government to take punitive action against the company, which denies any wrongdoing. In Israel, some experts are calling for better regulation of cyber exports. Linda Grandstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
An investigation by human rights groups and media outlets charges that various governments use the Israeli company NSO's Pegasus program to spy on dozens of journalists and dissidents worldwide. NSO called it a slanderous campaign and refused to respond to any more media queries. The company says it sells its software only to governments for the purpose of tracking terrorists and criminals. But some Israeli analysts say the cyber tool could have been used against harmless civilians.
Sometimes there is exploitation and sometimes there is utilization, harm utilization of those cyber security and cyber kind of tools. And the question is, what do you do in those cases? How do you make sure that the other country that has the right to use suddenly your software is using it according to your terms of licensing? And this is where the problem starts.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett responded to a call from French President Emmanuel Macron, who was identified as one of the targets of the NSO surveillance software, saying that Israel will investigate the allegations. Some Israeli legal experts suggest that the Israeli government should join the Wassenaar arrangement, in which 42 countries have pledged to make military and dual-use technology more transparent. But the legal experts say that NSO should ultimately take responsibility.
It's not enough that you intend well and you use your and you wish your products to be used only in certain ways. When you sell products to governments with very questionable and sometimes very bad human rights records, I mean, this is, in a way, an accident that is waiting to happen. And I think NSO also has to accept at least the ethical responsibility for what has happened.
Some cybersecurity analysts say the NSO affair has already damaged Israel's reputation.
We start to see the consequences and the damage that may be, first of all, to this private company, NSO, but also to Israel. And the damage may be not only in the cybersecurity domain, but also in the political and bilateral and multilateral layer.
Israel has reveled in its self-image as a startup nation, but the latest allegations show that advanced technology can also harm that image. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
This is the Voice of America. The beheading of a young woman in an upscale neighborhood in Pakistan's capital has put a spotlight on the relentless violence against women in the country. Rights activists say such gender-based assaults are on the rise as Pakistan moves towards greater religious extremism. A Human Rights Watch report says data collected from domestic violence hotlines across the country showed a 200% increase in domestic violence between January and March last year. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Vaccination programs against some of the world's deadliest diseases have saved millions of lives over the past 20 years, but continuing progress is threatened by the COVID-19 pandemic, as Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Emergency vaccination drive in the Democratic Republic of Congo after a measles outbreak in 2020. Efforts like this have saved millions of lives, says a study. Researchers looked at vaccination programs over the past two decades, targeting 10 infectious diseases across 112 low- and middle-income countries. They found that some 50 million lives, mostly those of children, had been saved by vaccines. They included diseases such as measles, hepatitis B, human papillomavirus or HPV, and yellow fever. The research was led by the Vaccine Impact Modelling Consortium, funded by Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Dr. Katie Gaythorpe of Imperial College London is one of the report's authors.
If we continued with the vaccinations in our projections, so beyond 2019, we'd avert another 47 million deaths. So huge numbers. And what we wanted to kind of show in this paper is this is what we projected vaccination to look like before the COVID pandemic, and wanted to emphasize, you know, these long-term effects, these long-term benefits of vaccination going into the future.
Immunization programs have added benefits beyond the prevention of specific diseases. Again, Dr. Katie Gaythorpe.
For example, if people aren't getting sick of vaccine-preventable diseases, then that means there's less stress on healthcare due to those infections, which means you could potentially be treating people for other things.
But the researchers warn that the COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted vaccination programs and could lead to a decline in coverage. Again, Dr. Katie Gaythorpe.
We've got not only healthcare services stretched by possibly treating people infected with COVID, we've also got people's personal choice. You know, they might put off going to seek an immunization just because of fears surrounding being infected with COVID.
The World Health Organization in April launched its Immunization Agenda 2030 to try to get vaccine programs back on track and reach even more people. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the continent's death toll from COVID-19 has jumped 17% in the past month. The African CDC said this week the infection rate has also increased and warned some countries are testing less often for the virus than needed. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
In his weekly online press briefing from Ethiopia, the head of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, John Nkengasong, gave a grim picture of the continent's COVID-19 situation during the month of July.
So there's been an average increase of 4% of new cases over that time period. In terms of the new deaths over the last 4 weeks, we've recorded an average of 17% average new deaths over that same period. In terms of testing, as a continent, as of today, we have conducted about 58 million COVID tests. And last week alone, the continent conducted about 1.3 million tests, but that represents a decrease of about 19% over the previous week. The overall positivity rate stands at 11.2%.
Overall, the continent recorded 239,000 coronavirus cases last week and 6,000 deaths, an increase of 7 deaths over the previous week. The Africa CDC blames increased deaths on virus spread events like the recent looting in South Africa and the celebration of Eid al-Hajj, the end of the Muslim pilgrimage in Mecca. It also blames the Delta variant, the most contagious form of coronavirus, which has spread across the globe in recent weeks. The continent's public health agency was happy that some African countries like South Africa, Nigeria and Kenya have managed to limit the virus while allowing economic activities to go on. Africa has so far received about 80 million vaccine doses from COVAX, the UN-backed global initiative to distribute vaccines to low and middle-income countries. The senior director for Africa at the US National Security Council, Dana Banks, said Wednesday her country has started to ship some 10 million vaccines to Africa.
We are happy to announce that we will be sending over 5 million doses to South Africa, as well as 4 million doses of Moderna vaccine to Nigeria. So we're very excited about that, and we hope that these will go a long way in helping to provide safety and health security for people of Nigeria and South Africa, which will then enable them to get back to their regular activities, their economic activities, and help them to build back better.
The World Health Organization has said at least 700 million vaccines will be sent to Africa by the end of the year, enough to vaccinate about 30% of the continent's 1.3 billion people. However, Matshidiso Moeti, WHO regional director, said African governments and health officials need to do more to encourage people to get the vaccines.
With the expected influx of vaccines, it is crucial that countries scale up all the aspects of vaccine rollout to reach as many people as possible. This entails mobilizing adequate resources, including finances for the vaccination activities, for the logistics and the personnel, as well as addressing any concerns by communities, including those fueled by misinformation, to increase vaccine confidence and demand.
So far, less than 2% of Africans have been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. The continent has officially recorded 6.5 million cases of the disease, although the real number is believed to be significantly higher. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Experts say in a few years, billionaires and their friends won't be the only ones who can afford to go to space. Plus, the Mars rover begins the search for ancient life, and new hardware arrives at International Space Station. VOA's Arash Rabasadi has This Week in Space.
To the next generation of dreamers, if we can do this, just imagine what you can do.
The business of space tourism appears ready to boom. It started this month with Virgin Group founder Richard Branson's successful flight aboard a Virgin Galactic plane that took him to the edge of space. And just 9 days later, Amazon and Blue Origin founder Jeff Bezos followed aboard his New Shepard rocket. Greg Autry is vice president of space development at the National Space Society and professor of space leadership at Thunderbird School of Global Management in Arizona. He tells VOA while it looks like only the ultra-wealthy and their hand-picked guests may ever see space, ordinary people could board rockets sooner than later.
When we get down to the next generation of flights, I think we're going to see $50,000 per ticket. I could do that. My wife would be very angry, but I can do that. That's a car, right? I think 10 years from now, we're in the thousands of dollars, and it is a mode of transportation point to point, and you get a free space ride while you do it. And people will pay that extra premium for the space ride.
John Strickland is at-large director of the National Space Society and has written about colonizing space. He tells VOA large-scale accessibility to space travel is now a matter of human destiny.
It was not going to be an infinite amount of time before you had the cost coming down with reusable rockets and the safety factor going up as the reliability of the Falcon 9 rocket is pretty well demonstrated now.
Strickland was referencing SpaceX's reusable Falcon 9 rocket, which NASA has used in official missions. Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic say they've collectively sold hundreds of millions of dollars worth of tickets for future flights. Elsewhere in the solar system, NASA's Perseverance rover rolls closer to the starting line of a groundbreaking mission, collecting Martian rock samples to be studied for signs of ancient life. Project managers say they expect Percy, that's the rover's nickname, will gather rocks from the floor of the Jezero crater, which scientists think was once a lake bed. Experts say any signs of life detected would likely be microbial. Finally, a Russian lab module with new hardware on board docked at the International Space Station Thursday morning. The module carried a new toilet for the ISS, along with the European robotic arm, or ERA. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great weekend.